Here in the second chapter, what's happening is Shukadeva Goswami is continuing to answer a question that was asked at the end of the first canto. The question at the end of the first canto was a two-part question. What should one do at the time of death? Because he knew that he was going to die in 7 days. And what is that subject matter that one should always hear, chant, and remember? Which I absorb my consciousness in, because the hearing process helps one become absorbed in something. So, just thinking, hearing Prabhupada discuss this morning. There are different types of people. Just as there are different types of people, there's different types of insects and different types of birds. The crows, they like hanging out where there's garbage. Those of you from India, you're very familiar with that scene. They go where the garbage is, and they love it. And the swans love very calm, clear lakes where there's lotus flowers, and swim within the flowers. We don't find crows there, we don't find swans in the garbage. You go to the garbage and you always find crows, and go to the clear lakes and you always find nice, peaceful birds like swans. Or flies. They love stool. And bees, they love honey. You don't find the bees where there's stool. You don't find the flies where there's honey. Or there's flowers with pollen. So as with birds, there are different varieties. As with insects, there's different varieties. So with people, Prabhupada was describing, you go to somebody's library and see what's on their library shelf. Now, depending upon the mode of nature that they're impelled by, there's something about guns, or something about sex literature, or something about poetry and music, and the modes of nature are represented by what someone is interested in. In their literature. So this transcendental literature, Srimad Bhagavatam, is for the Paramahamsas. The swan is the Hamsa, and the transcendentalist is the Paramahamsa. And it's meant to transform crows, into Paramahamsas. Just by the sound vibration. It's the way of Vedic life. Sound vibration affects consciousness. And so, what is the duty of someone who's about to die? Well, two things are mentioned in the first chapter. Form a conception of God. Even if it means, if you have none, see God within nature. And detach oneself from the temporary things of life. Second chapter begins. This form of God within nature, it's called Virat Rupa. Rupa means form, and Virat means this creation, material creation. The form of the universe. So he says that Brahma, at the beginning of each day of Brahma, part of his sadhana, before he goes to the office and punches the clock, before he does his duties, he fixes his mind, meditates upon the form of the universe, because that's what he's supposed to do. He's supposed to make one of those. So that's the prototype and the subtle form, and then he makes one in a gross form. He takes the impression. And by taking that impression, his slumber of forgetfulness is cast away. Because he forgets, like we forget, what our real life is. So by meditation upon the form of the Lord, our sense of real life becomes reawakened. And to some degree, the natural attraction, like the excitement about being in relationship with the Lord, awakens. And from that comes buddhi yoga, or vyavasayatmaka buddhi, comes this intelligence how to reach him. Vyavasayatmaka buddhi, ekeha kuru nandino. That Krishna gives in spiritual intelligence how to reach him. And through the medium of devotional service, one's desire to serve him in a loving mood becomes manifest. So those are progressive stages that are mentioned. Where we're headed through this message is come to the full stage of love of God in service to him. So while stating that's what Brahma does, he then goes the opposite direction and says, one shouldn't be bewildered, my dear king, by the way of Shabdasya, the Vedic sounds, into thinking that the phantasmagoria of happiness in the heavenly planets is to be sought. That's not what the duty of one who's about to die, or the duty of people who are not unnoticed that in 7 days they're going to die like you. Don't search out the appeal, the so-called attraction of material happiness in this world or the next. That's it's a very misleading aspiration. And messages that direct one to that, they're also misleading. So what should one do while within this world? This is where we ended up yesterday. There's this place where we are now, he calls the world of names. World of names. It's a philosophical idea that here there's category. Interesting. Here there's category, and in the spiritual world there's substance. Substance and category. Like, we discussed this, but there's a whole section from Plato's writings about the realm of the absolutes. We can infer the existence of the realm of the absolutes from things that exist here. Things that exist here, there's no substance. We say chair. He spends chapters discussing a chair. What was it before it was a chair? It was something else. What was it before it was something else? It was something else. What was it before it was something else? It was something else. Now we're calling it a chair. And what will it be later? It's going to be something else. What's the substance? The substance is a chair. It's a category. So where did this chair come from? Before there was a chair, there was an idea. Chair. Where did that idea of chair come from? This is how philosophers go on and on about it. It came from someplace, so he infers by logic and reason, there's this realm where in substance there's chair. Or plural, there's chairs. And from that realm of absolutes comes this idea of chair, and then we make a chair. And so it goes with things of this world. It's category, or here's world of names, or in language that Prabhupada uses in Bhagavad Gita, it's phenomena, but then there's this noumena, that which is substance. And so one should, while in this world of names, we have this thing called the body, it's another name, and the body has certain demands, like some food and some rest, defense. Make whatever arrangements that are necessary that are minimal. That's the instruction. Don't endeavor for fancy arrangements for things in this world of names. Recognize that it's phantasmagoria. Summary statement, one sentence in the purport, Prabhupada writes that human life is never meant for self-realization, for sense gratification, but for self-realization. So go for the spiritual side, go for the noumenal side, go for the substance, not for the category side, the world of names side, trying to make a permanent settlement in this temporary place. It's impermanent. Like Prabhupada gave a lecture once in Detroit. He was visiting. They had a rented house, big three-story house to fill up with lots of devotees. And Prabhupada said, so for my arrangement, you've gotten an apartment so I can stay. Now while here, should I make it my dedicated focus to make a nice arrangement for my apartment, knowing in a few days I'm gone? Is that what I should do? And similarly, how long will we be in this place? Is our business to make it a nice place? Like the question yesterday about, is it okay to make something comfortable? So, here's the message of this section. Because there's several verses in the world that discuss it. In short, necessity, fine. Beyond necessity, don't invest this valuable human energy, human life form, in temporary, in asat, in the world of names, but invest it in realizing the self. That's the message here. The transcendentalist is specifically warned herewith to be fixed in mind, so that even if there is difficulty in plain living and high thinking, he will not budge an inch from his stark determination. So this is, you could say, simple living, high thinking. Prabhupada often used that phrase, couplet, simple living, high thinking, keep it simple. It's one of the qualities of a brahmana, is simplicity. Simplicity can mean different things. Bhaktisiddhanta elaborately discusses this in a book that's about that thick on Brahmanism and Vaishnavism. One way of simplicity is, if you don't need it, do without it. But consider, if you have to acquire something, you're thinking about getting something for the family, for the house, or whatever, think twice about it. Think thrice about it. Think several times about it before. If you don't need it, do without it. If you need it, okay. If you don't need it, simplicity. That's one sense of simplicity. Another sense of simplicity that Bhaktisiddhanta emphasizes even more is being straightforward in dealings. It's kind of like truthfulness, but it's more just You speak the truth and you don't pretend to be what you're not. A phrase that comes in the fourth chapter is Gata Vyalika, which Prabhupada translates as beyond pretension. So that's the opposite. Pretension, simplicity. Just whatever you are, it's transparent. You're not hiding something, saying something, doing another something. Duplicity. It's simplicity. You are what you say, and you say what you are, and no pretension. I'd like to become more than what I am. I'd like to get closer to Krishna. And by getting closer to Krishna, nicer qualities will become decorations by Krishna's arrangement. So it's not complacency by being straightforward, but it's not being duplicitous either. So now texts 4 and 5, I'll just read them, express some highlights from them, and kind of summarize. They're so wonderful, it's nice to read the whole thing. Text 4. When there are ample earthly flats to lie on, what is the necessity of cots and beds? This is like, keep it simple. Renunciation of the idea that happiness is having things that are temporary. When one can use his own arms, what is the necessity of a pillow? When one can use the palms of his hands, what is the necessity of varieties of utensils? When there's ample covering, or the skins of trees, what is the necessity of clothing? Oh, we can, no. When Ram was in exile, he was wearing tree bark. When he returned from exile, he didn't wear tree bark. The idea is not, you know, to become radical or fanatical or something. Rather, the idea is don't invest valuable human energy in the so-called happiness of temporary, what people might call comfort zone, even beyond that, luxury. It's a very unfortunate waste of human energy. It's, in one word, it's nivritti. Nivritti is mentioned in the first verses of the first canto. The Bhagavatam is the path of nivritti, as opposed to pravritti. Pravritti is one approaches spiritual life with a very clear purpose of increasing one's involvement with the material energy in a more refined way. Pravritti. Like seeking higher grade of enjoyment in this life and after this life. Pravritti. Nivritti is the opposite. It's decreasing deliberately, gradually, one's involvement with the material energy for the sake of taking that valuable human energy and investing it in the eternal. The most important thing is investing it in the eternal, because by so doing, the attraction for the temporary will diminish. But one should also understand, at least by transcendental knowledge, the futility of investing energy in the temporary. It's childish. It's like spending so much time going to the beach and building a sandcastle knowing that the tide is going to come in and completely wash away the whole sandcastle. Like Prabhupada's example, should I spend my few days in Detroit making a very nice arrangement in this apartment that I'm only going to leave? It's childish. But people do that. The opening opening paragraph expresses, the opening sentence of the paragraph expresses the theme, the necessities of life for the protection and comfort of the body must not unnecessarily be increased. Human energy is spoiled in a vain search after such illusory happiness. And he then describes that are we in a better position in the human form of life if we're doing the same thing that the animals do, but just in a more polished form, and that's the limit of our progress above an animal life? This polished animal life makes us more advanced. It's really missing what the purpose of the human form of life is. What the animals cannot do is strive for self-realization, and that's the distinction where human life sets itself apart from animal life. Otherwise, it's polished animal life. While saying that, it doesn't mean that we should disrespect animals, or nor that we should imitate and follow them, but rather the human form of life should be conducted in such a way what we require, we take care of, and the balance of that human energy should be for higher thinking. Prabhupada specifically says, mentioned, try to utilize his intelligence in arts and science, poetry and philosophy. High thinking, not animal thinking. How to make arrangements for my animal propensities, eating, sleeping, mating, defending. Advancement of human civilization must be towards the goal of establishing our lost relationship with God, which is not possible in any form of life other than human. So, again, this is our human mission. Like that question yesterday, that man sitting with his back over on this side is birth and over on that side is death, and in between is what we call life. What are we supposed to be doing? Most people don't pause. They just accumulate and, you know, go just get on the conveyor belt of life and do what as all the others are doing. Like lemmings, just follow the lead lemming. Wherever they're going. And where are we going? That was the purpose of the talk yesterday. Where are we, just to get people to think, where are we going? Whoa, wait a minute. Is this the right path to be following of leading our life? Just more and faster. Where's it going? Don't ask that question. More and faster. Wait, I want to ask where we're going. Where are we going? And who are we? What? Who am I? People get uncomfortable when you ask that question, I found. In the museum in Los Angeles, maybe some of you have been to that temple, Los Angeles Temple. If you go to Los Angeles Temple, be sure to do three things. See Rukmini Dwarapadish, go to the Govinda's restaurant, in that order, and then if their museum is open, they have the Fate Museum, you can go into the Fate Museum, it's right next to the restaurant. And you go inside in one of the exhibits, it's all high-tech, you know, computerized, and it works. They maintain it nicely. And one of the panels, you go inside, and it's like you're in India, all the lights go out. So it's dark, and everybody's looking around. You can't even see anybody because it's fully dark. Then all of a sudden, a light comes on from behind you and shines against like a mylar mirror And everybody's looking at this mylar mirror, and it's yourselves, everybody that's standing there. And then this resonating British voice comes on the little background music and says, "Who are you? Take a good look at yourself. Are you really that body? Have you ever asked yourself the question who you really are?" And the light goes out again. And then you hear some nice classical music. And from inside, behind the mylar, a spotlight goes on to the little baby and the changing bodies. So you hear on top of the classical music, you hear the heartbeat of the little baby in the womb. And then light on the child and the embryo comes on, and then that spotlight fades and another spotlight comes on at the same time, and it's a little baby. You hear the you all know the sound. And then the light, that light comes on. And then that light fades, the spotlight fades, and as simultaneously another, and you hear children playing in the schoolyard, bouncing with the ball, and these shrill voices of children all playing together, and classical music is going on. And it goes through all the phases of life and starts to get, you know, like really heavy classical music, like, you know, the boom, 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 there's an approaching death. And then you hear a guy coughing, weird. And that light disappears and comes over again to the baby. And then the voice comes on and says, and explains the exhibit. Actually, who we really are is that spiritual spark that's transmigrating through different stages of life. All this other is temporary. It's not our real identity. And some kind of message like that, thoughtful persons can understand. Our real self is an eternal spark. There's a fragment of the spiritual identity of the personality of Godhead. And so, while we're passing through this temporary place between birth and death, our business is not, you know, gather as many things in a basket as we can, and that makes us successful. Information in our information basket, goods in our goods basket, and one who has the biggest basket wins. That's not the message of the Bhagavatam. Don't make that mistake. Don't use the human form of life in that way. One must realize the nullity of material phenomena, considering it a passing phantasmagoria, and must endeavor to make a solution to the miseries of life. He gives the example of Rupa and Sanatana Goswami. Prabhupada liked to refer to this part of their life. They were fabulously wealthy. They were politically right on top of the pile. They were prime minister and home minister in the government of Nawab Hussein Shah. Spoke seven languages, respected by everybody. You know, they were up there. They gave it all up. Chakvatur Namashesha Mandala Pratikshini. They just, like, it didn't mean anything to them. For the service of Krishna, they left, made Vrindavan their residence under Lord Chaitanya's order, slept on the ground. They, for cloth, it was discarded cloth, one piece, they had a total of two pieces, one that they were wearing, one that was drying. And that's it, that was their wardrobe. These were like kings, and didn't care for it. But they did give immense, living in that lifestyle, they gave immense literature. It's going to come in the next purport. So then Prabhupada concludes this by saying, ideal is that one can be trained in this way from childhood. And if one isn't trained in this way from childhood, like most people aren't, then at whatever stage, it may be difficult, but whatever stage, it should be cultivated. If one is not accustomed to abiding by the life of renunciation and self-abnegation from the beginning, one should try to get into the habit at a later stage of life, as recommended by Shrivati Goswami. And that will help one to achieve the desired success. Oh, best and second best. But at whatever stage, one should detach oneself from the expectation that happiness will come by bringing the senses in contact with a certain set of sense objects. Very important message of Bhagavad Gita. Yehi samsparsha jabhoga dukkha yonai evate. It's the source of dukkha, although our expectation was sukha. Happiness, sukha, is get that product. Get the money so you can get that product, so you can get sukha. The process of getting that product is dukkha, but the product itself is also dukkha. It doesn't bring happiness, and it, so that disappointment then leads one to frustration and anger, like the presentation yesterday. That people expect their share, and they don't get it, and they're angry. They get it, and they're frustrated. It didn't do it. An item I didn't show is that the highest rate of suicide is amongst the wealthiest class of people. Because they all the way up to the top of the mountain, and it's as shallow as at the bottom of the mountain. In my years of book distribution, I met several people. I used to distribute books in the airports. I would meet people and give them a Bhagavad Gita and say different things, Eastern wisdom of how to find happiness within. People would stop, right in their, get in their tracks, very opulent people, saying, you know, when I was younger, I was so much happier. Now my life is so complex. I'm flying off to someplace and I need to meet with all these puffed up people, and they're not at all interested in me. They don't care about me. They don't care about values of life. They care about one thing: making some money, and so they can feel good about themselves. And, you know, I'm on this treadmill, and I don't like it. I was much happier when I was younger. Life was much simpler, much more, you know, very happy to receive the book. This message is relatable to a lot of people if they are the thoughtful type. Next verse, I'll try to do it quickly, although it's over a 2-page purport. I just summarize the points. The verse is more of the same. Are there no torn clothes lying on the common road? Do the trees which exist for maintaining others no longer give alms and charity? Do the rivers, being dried up, no longer supply water to the thirsty? Are the caves of the mountains now closed? Or above all, does the Almighty Lord not protect the fully surrendered souls? Why then do the learned sages go to flatter those who are intoxicated by hard-earned wealth? So Prabhupada does both sides of this issue, he's advocating simplicity and renunciation even. So the renunciate should not be a parasite. He even gives a dictionary definition. A parasite is a sycophant who lives at the cost of society without making any contribution to that society. So he says on the one side, the renunciate should not have the mentality, I'll go to people, this is an easy way to maintain myself. Rather, if they go to people, it's only for engaging people in some higher service. It's to help them become detached. That's why that should be the spirit of the renunciate. Go the other direction, if the renunciate is thinking, this is a great means of maintaining myself, then it's a disgrace for the, all the acharyas who voluntarily accept the renounced order of life aimed at benefiting human society and not at living a comfortable or irresponsible life at the cost of others. And so he goes through a list of how the renounced order of life is to make contribution to others. And so that's where energy, valuable human energy, is to be invested. If you dismiss these other things, invest your energy in. He's giving a list. His list includes making contributions of literature, as the Goswamis did, volumes and volumes of transcendental literature for the benefit of human society, in order to give realized direction towards self-realization. Whether it's whole discourses, he gives the examples. Rupa and Sanatana Jiva Goswami holding their discourses at Sevakunj in the area where Jiva Goswami lived. They would come together and discuss Krishna conscious topics together. That's how the valuable human energy should be used. When taking up that path of detachment, one should become attached or dependent upon the Supreme, the symptom of surrender. I'll try to do this quickly. In Nectar of Devotion, we have a list of six items that are the symptoms of surrender. It's taken from Padma Purana. And two of those items are in this purport. One is maintenance, the other is protection. Gopritve Varanam Tava. One who surrendered to the Supreme Lord feels oneself being maintained by Him, just like a child has a sense of being maintained by their loving parents. They're not independent from their parents. They're being maintained by the parents. It doesn't make them less loving to be maintained. It's a sense of dependence, a sense of gratitude. So the material disease is thinking independent, and surrender is to think when one is being maintained by one's work. It's not your work that's maintaining you, it's Krishna that's maintaining you. Because some people work and have very little, some people work and have a lot. Who is the maintainer? Is it the work or is it the Supreme? I can't help but tell a little anecdote. It happened to me. I was once at a GBC meeting, and I finished a GBC meeting, and I was traveling by train from Calcutta to Bihar. I was visiting a devotee that lived in Ranchi. And it was a night train, got on the train. My practice when getting on night trains is to take rest really, like first thing, because people are doing their blah blah things, just distractions. So just take rest, get up early, and take bath and try to finish chanting before people get up and start doing their blah blah thing again. So I had gotten up and was chanting, and across the way in the compartment was a businessman. He got up and in sequence, he took his breakfast tea and then he brushed his teeth. And then he sat down and looked at me like, you know, the very confrontational Bob. And he said, so? You also need money to exist? So his message was, you parasite. You're living off of the energy of people like me that work very hard. But he didn't say that, he just said it. So, you also need money to exist? And I said, politely, those who are living a life of renunciation, same message as here. They must perform a valuable service for society. But he just kept on his track and said, where do you get your necessities? And my reply was, from the same place you get your necessities. The difference is, you're thinking, by my fruitive work, I'm getting my necessities. And my thinking is, by depending upon Krishna, my necessities are provided. And if I'm thinking necessities doing nothing, then that's a parasite. But those who are living a brahminical life, their duty is study of the scriptures and cleanliness and giving guidance to the whole of society. What do you think? At the end of the conversation, he just said, he took his paper, he put this paper up like this. That was the end of the conversation. So where there's the fruitive spirit is very strong, and even for those that are taking up spiritual life, it's very strong. It's very, very strong. That is, thinking that just in case Krishna forgets me, I got to keep my option in my other pocket over here. That's my hard work, and by my hard work I'll maintain myself and my family, and all necessities will be there, just in case, Krishna fell asleep. Or something, neglected me, when the serve out happened, the server just passed me and went to the next guy. So, the spirit of one who's following this message of the Bhagavatam is not just for the sannyasi mendicant. This is for someone that's living in this world and living a responsible life. The sense of surrender to the Supreme Lord is, it is He who is maintaining me. I certainly do my work, my duties of life, because they're for the Supreme. But it's not my duties that are maintaining me. My work is maintaining me. The Supreme Lord is maintaining me, and I'm serving Him. That's our relationship. I'm the servant, and He's the master. And certainly the master will take care of the servant. And that's what's happening. According to my requirements, according to my desire. And as far as protection is concerned, Prabhupada gives the example of Haridas Thakur, and he was living in a cave, and there's this serpent that was so poisonous that there were fumes when people would come, and it was burning their eyes. The fumes from the poison. But Haridas, we can't even see you. Our eyes are so disturbed by the fumes. And what about you? I have no problem. But we're afraid for your well-being. And Haridas said, I'm not disturbed, but if you're disturbed, then I'll leave. By tomorrow, if the snake is not going on. As they were speaking, the serpent with a big jewel on his hood, big serpent, by inspiration of Super Soul, he dribbled his way out of the cave. So Prabhupada's point is, this is a tangible example of how the Lord gives protection to a bona fide devotee like Thakur Haridas, according to the regulations of the Sanatan Dharma Institution. One is trained from the beginning to depend fully on the protection of the Lord in all circumstances. This is how a devotee lives. It becomes a way of life. It's not like we don't unnecessarily take risks and put ourselves and others in a risky situation because Krishna will maintain us, so although it's rush hour traffic, we'll just go right across the highway and Krishna will protect us. You don't do foolish things. But when we do reasonable things, the understanding is the outcome is up to Krishna, and protection is something I can be sure of. Safety and well-being and requirements of life are taken care of by Krishna. Just a couple other points in the end. Prabhupada speaks of daivisampat. Daivisampat means spiritual assets, in contrast to non-spiritual assets. People are very careful to accumulate their assets, worldly assets. The message that's being presented here. He refers to chapter 16, Bhagavad Gita. One should not look for the asuri sampat, but the daivi sampat. And that's a service that a spiritual personality, whether it's the renunciate or the properly situated grihastha, is to give spiritual asset for your association. Practically speaking, the grihastha has far more opportunity to associate with unfortunate people. So be sure that when you're doing that, you're giving spiritual asset as far as, you know, the mission of the human life is concerned. Conclusion. One can become fixed in one's prescribed duty by faithful oral reception of the Vedic instructions and assimilation of the essence of Vedic knowledge by devotional service to the Lord. That's the conclusion. So how does that apply? These messages are the Bhagavatam's message. Our consciousness can become fixed by oral reception. Just like the discussion yesterday with the at the yoga festival or wherever it was. By Vedic sound, by spiritual sound, one's consciousness can become fixed. And that fixed is attachment to the Supreme, detachment from unnecessary things. Necessary things, okay. Unnecessary things. So that it starts with hearing, but then Prabhupada also says assimilation. Assimilation means it goes in the heart, and we live our life accordingly. Shrinvanti gayanti grinanti sadhavaha. Hearing, vibrating, assimilating, letting it go in, and so that your life is lived by those principles, application of those principles in one's life. Then that it enriches our access to Krishna. That's our main mission. Is there any discussion on this?
You started talking about the practice sort of putting these principles into practice.
Yeah.
But on a daily basis, you know, for example, association with devotees, this happens maybe, you know, every weekend or so. And also, we're not always discussing, you know, the challenges we're going through in these terms with the devotees. So I'm just wondering if there's anything specific in terms of, you know, a day in one's life.
Well, sadhana is something that you can do in your home.
Mm-hmm.
And sangha is something that's commonly practiced these days by use of technology. For example, there are several situations where devotees I know of are conducting daily Bhagavad Gita discussions. Some are doing it morning and evening. Now, with a fixed time, and the people are unable to attend for some reason, okay, it's fine. But every morning, every evening, every morning, every evening, every morning, every evening, yeah. You call into a conference number,
mm-hmm.
and it's very regulated. It begins on time and it ends on time. And it's so structured, and in some cases there's even homework, or if there's not homework, it says preview, this is what we're going to be covering, the main points.
Mm-hmm.
And then just, you know, covering and discussing. And then some even have PowerPoints that they send out, so it's, you've got it on your screen.
Mm-hmm.
So you can review the main points. And so then, you know, there's discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And, boom, you know, you don't have to drive somewhere, go anywhere. It's just busy people. It helps. And some are at different levels. Some are introductory, like very, very beginner people. Some are... So that's one option. I don't know if something like that could be set up here, but if something can't be set up here, I could give you the contact information of people that are doing that elsewhere. I don't, two of the, there's three happening in Chicago. One just started up. I don't think she's doing it daily. I think she's starting with the idea of doing it weekly. And then as people become interested, you know, in the group, and she'll expand. But there's others that are going 5 days of the week. It's, it goes Tuesday through Friday, and then they have a Saturday morning something. Then you don't, you know, you don't have the prasadam preparation, you don't have the driving. You know, it just, and sangha, it works. Where there's interest, again, it's scheduling is sometimes the problem, but gathering together locally, aside from the telephone, just gathering together and having some reading.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in short, where there's thoughtfulness, there's a way to do it. Personal or like this, because it's close by to where you are. The Bhagavad Gita class that's at the university,
yes.
On Friday from noon to one. So as the community grows, it seems that it's growing. Then different options, and ones that are proximate and ones that work for your schedule. And life is always, these days, ever changing in terms of deadlines and demands and timings of things. So, you know, some people are, they're with a regular group and then they have to drop out because of circumstance and then they rejoin and maybe join another group. You know, if there's diversity, it helps. As long as, you know, someone isn't attached to, you know, something. If you drop out, we don't like you anymore. That's sangha, and that. But that's again. That's something that you can do in your home. If it's just a sadhana meeting, and a situation that I know that happens in the afternoon, there's a group of. It started with two, and then it became three, and then it became four ladies. At a certain time in the afternoon, they read for half an hour. Mm-hmm. And they started reading the small books because that was easy. Then they decided, hey, let's read Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. I was getting, you know, what does this mean? What does that mean? Kind of questions. Mm-hmm. Now they're into the eighth canto of the Bhagavatam. Half an hour every day at a fixed time. They would, you know, they would work around that time, between this time and that time, half hour. And, you know, they would, some reading and some... some reading and some discussing. So when there's a will, there's a way.
It helps to be able to... ways of
Something else?
How do we distinguish this thing between necessity and luxury? Because sometimes between if I want something, it's very easy to justify that I need it.
Well, here's a rule, just a rule of thumb. Of course, if you're thinking this way, is like 80% of the problem. Not thinking that way is you know, you don't even consider it, just impulse. But if you're thinking that way, how will my life be without it? And, you know, live your life for a while without it. See if you really need it. Just let some time pass and observe. And then, so then when you have it, you'll use it. Because some, I've seen, households are filled with gadgets that people never use. So do without it for a while, see what, and then, if that point, another side of it is, if that point in time comes that you used it, you don't use it anymore, give it away. Let somebody else use it. That's another, because the tendency is in household life just to gather paraphernalia. It never gets used. Because someday we need it. So, I'm not recommending being fanatical. But I'm recommending being thoughtful about these abundant times right here. You know, it's not like an over-exercise. You have to be fearful if I get something, I may be violating Shukadeva Goswami's instruction here. But be thoughtful about it. But just review in your mind. Just put it down on paper. These are the reasons. All the time, as I'm traveling, people ask me, can we give you this and can we give you that? My short answer is, I only have one suitcase. And, you know, I can only carry so much. And this is, you know, that's a heavy item I keep. Okay, thanks. Oh, but you can do so many things with it. And you know, I'm quite happy without it. I don't really need it. But if it's useful, then take, you know, use it carefully. Does that help? For a long time, I didn't want to have a computer because I saw what it did to people's lives. It just grabbed their energy and gobbled them up and sucked them in. So I wouldn't keep a computer. I did correspondence a different way than email. I would, you know, dictate letters and people would type them and they would send me. Then email would come, they would print it out, I'd read them, dictate letters and give them the cassette. And, you know, I didn't want a computer. Then, you know, I thought about it, I thought about it, I thought about it. So it's useful. So the problem is then when something is useful, then to get, you know, not get, have it just drain your energy. Mm-hmm. Spend your whole time with this gadget. Waste your valuable human energy with paraphernalia. When it's needed, okay. And when it's not needed, so that's the operative chapter. How can this be used effectively in Krishna's service? Okay. Wait, need. And so it's the difference between the mind and practicality. And so that your comment was, it's easy to have the mind convince you I need it.
Yeah.
So then you separate the mind from reality. Mind your mind, you're over there. Now, what's reality? Like right behind me, there's this piece of paper. So that's, you know, you buy some paper for the kids to scribble on. But, you know, here's the evidence that it's nice to have it. Because then later on, there's, you know, either it's just this ugly wall with markings all over it, or you how many times you have to paint your wall, those people that have small children. So that's useful. It's not so expensive, okay. That's kind of consideration. I haven't seen this before, but it's very clever. And then, you know, when the kids get old enough that they don't scribble on the wall anymore, give the rest of the role to somebody that has little kids and likes to scribble on the wall. Just like there's a devotee named Vladini Shakti that had this wonderful association, a very wonderful devotee, and he knew he had this collecting propensity. So it was this ritual every year. He'd spread all this stuff out and select things out and distribute them and put it all back together again. It's good. Practice. Things you don't need. And before taking another something, do I need it? I heard you already mind, but now let's let the intelligence be active here. Is it needed? It's a cultivation. In service to Krishna, yes. Otherwise, something else?
I love what this is. Well, I also mean someone speaking your mind. But sometimes in the corporate culture, it becomes difficult because if you speak your mind, you can get in trouble. How do you know that?
One has to use some discretion. It if you think in terms of principle, I would say two things. Speak sparingly and speak principle. Because principle is something that resonates with everybody. You know, greed may just push principle to the side. But you speak principle and people, it connects, even if they may not like it. Like, you know, some cutting some corner and end up, let's say, with a company cheating the customer. So the principle is, you know, what do we want? Do we want flash in a pan, or do we want something that's, what is our organization? If we want to be, we want the respect of and the trust, building a base of trust and respect over time, then let us not cut corners. Because we may get a quick, you know, increased sales over here, but we'll lose credibility. But you speak principle. Whatever the application of that might be. That's leadership. You speak on principle. You may not even be the lead of the team, but you speak principle. And you're influencing the team, giving leadership to the team. It's making decisions about, well, you know, how we're going to produce, make our product, and market it.
I have a similar question.
Okay.
It's about this issue of simplicity. And so some of us, we can't necessarily extract ourselves from complex situations in life, you know, working in school. So is simplicity of motivation is that essentially what we need to do? And then if we get a chance later on, also fix up.
Even within the context of the complexity, you strive for simplicity. If you're not striving for simplicity, you're going to get washed away. The tide comes and the waves are heavy. You just get washed away. So strive for simplicity, even in the midst of complexity. While everybody else is doing this, you know, yada, yada, yada program, keep simple. As a principle. And because it's the right principle, It gives strength of character, it brings respect and respectability. It'll win in the long run. So stick this within the limits of the circumstance, strive for simplicity. You can think about that in terms of particular applications, but it's a principle of life. A principle of life is like a light off in the distance, in the darkness. You're in a dark place called the material world, and over there is a light. Just move towards the light. Direct your movements and your decisions and your activities and your speech towards that principle. When you live your life that way, Krishna sees that effort and Krishna gives spiritual strength to you. But while you're doing your feelings, Krishna's giving spiritual strength. And Krishna also helps you be an agent to bring about a reconfiguration of matter based upon your Krishna consciousness that you're carrying. Like this question that came last night about should we be political activists. I believe that we should be Krishna conscious. And that will make the best form of activism possible. I have direct experience of that happening in many different ways. The power of a Krishna conscious person in the midst of this world of chaos brings order to chaos by their spiritual influence. I've seen it. Even, you know, in everyday workplace situations. And one who has that simplicity of faith becomes a change agent for the workplace. And so it's a little microcosm of the macrocosm. But that's how change takes place, one step at a time. The people that you come in contact with in your school or in the workplace, those are people that you can have, based upon your Krishna consciousness, you can have some spiritual influence. Even you may not be, you know, sitting them down and chanting japa together or having kirtan, just by the Krishna consciousness that you carry. But it's not just the keeping it simple as much as, more important, is the faith in Krishna or following the instruction to do so, like the spiritual connection. The behavior follows that. And the spiritual influence also follows that faith, that Krishna consciousness. That applies equally for renunciate as it does for the householder. The application, the form of the application is different. The principle doesn't change. One of the main relationships between the Vaishnava renunciate and the Vaishnava householder is giving strength to that principle. But then the householder Vaishnava can affect change in the world in a way that a renunciate Vaishnava can't, and vice versa. It's a principle. In principles, light rules over darkness. It's stronger. Then there's all the abouts. But it's so dark over here. Light's stronger. So the principle doesn't change. There are natural laws. Like this, one of the presentations that I recently made is even quoting secular people, saying the same thing. Where is that principle that's derived by secular people? From where is it derived? It's derived from spiritual reality. They get their strength in spiritual reality. It's just a little slice of spiritual reality, and they, you know, blend it. Emerson wrote a book, an essay, called something like Spiritual Principle. And in that spiritual principle essay, he's speaking about how people try to bring about change by their endeavor, and try to bring about success through their endeavor. But a little observation shows that's not how things happen. but that where there's obedience to natural law and striving accordingly, it gives that person strength that others don't have to bring about something that resembles that principle, more closely resembles that principle. And persons with faith and natural principle are strong people. They give leadership to others who aren't as strong. That's how change is made. Of course, there's the other kind of people. So there's always this asura and sura dichotomy since the beginning of creation. Right now, the asuras are having the upper hand. Big time. But what to do? Strive by principle, with faith, and you get strength. You find the strength in that. It's amazing. And then it's not you doing it, it's something else is making things happen. That's a nice feeling. Being an instrument of a higher principle in this world. Anything else?